Tonight we're going to look at the topic of life comes from life. Did everyone read or is familiar with Prabhupada's book, Life Comes from Life? Mm-hmm. Everyone has read that. You have not read that. You heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Life Comes from Life? No.
No.
Okay. So that's a book Srila Prabhupada wrote, actually not wrote, it's conversations recorded with Srila Prabhupada from 1974, where he talks with some of his disciples, in particular one disciple called Srab Damodar, who is also a professor of chemistry, Dr. Singh, Taudam Singh is his name. And there Prabhupada is addressing the idea that life comes from chemicals, which is kind of, you know, many modern scientists' idea. That life, I mean, that we're just a pile of chemicals. And life arose on its own by chemical combination on the earth many billions of years ago. And then it has evolved, you know, over billions and billions of years gradually to become what life is today, you know. And here we talk about, of course, evolution, Darwin's theories, and like that. And Prabhupada, many devotees have read this book, and actually they were immediately impressed because Prabhupada gives very direct, simple arguments and actually prove that that cannot be true. He points out very simple that we have never seen life come from chemicals. No scientist has gone to the laboratory and put the right chemicals together, and voila, something living comes out. Never happened. It only starts. The only thing we know that gives rise to life is life. You know, that's how it is. We see a father and mother, they're living, their life, and a child is a result, another life. You see that everywhere. You have a seed that comes from a living, comes from life, a tree, and you plant a seed, and then life comes out. And you even have that on, you know, microbes, bacteria. Everywhere you can easily see life comes from life, but life comes from matter has never been observed. So Prabhupada says, so that goes to prove that life must come, the original source of everything must be living and not dead. And how can you call it science? I mean, they say in the past it happened like that, life arose from chemicals. Then when you want it proved, they say we'll do it in the future. Prabhupada said, this is not science. You have to show now. You cannot show now this. In this, they say, we'll do it in the future, or we're almost there. Prabhupada said, this is just bluffing. There's no substance. It's not science. Science means you can demonstrate it right now. And a minute ago, myself included, when I read that, I said, he's right. It's actually a fact. No one has demonstrated it. So it's just a belief, a modern materialistic belief. But it's very widespread. Practically everyone believes it. In the modern world, that's what you learn in schools. Of course, the idea that God created it, the life and like that, that you learn in religion. But that's, who can take that really as seriously as some scientific topic? Then when you actually have science in schools and education, biology and so on, then you learn life came from chemistry. But it's not science. There is actually no proof that this happens, and there's much proof that it's completely untrue. And Prabhupada, he wanted devotees to look into that and to address it even deeply scientifically, and therefore he started his own scientific institute called the Bhaktivedanta Institute, where Srab Damodar Maharaj, who was talking with Prabhupada in this Life Come From Life book, he became the leading scientist, and there were other scientists also, notably Sariputta, Hare Krishna. One devotee named Madhava was there. Later on, Drutakarma has been very prominent, and I mean, there's been devotees involved with the Bhaktivedanta Institute work, addressing and looking into, you know, scientific arguments for this, that life comes from life, and defeating the idea of Darwin. And so I've also been somewhat involved with that, been, you know, studying it all along these years, reading what came, whatever our devoted scientists they were writing, and listening to many lectures and like that. And then from about 15 years ago, I got myself even more into it, started writing on it and lecturing on it. I also wrote a couple of things. I wrote a book on it that has been published and has been distributed all over the world now, published by the PPT, which was actually, because at that time I thought that was around 2004-5. I was thinking at that time that actually some really good publications came out in the beginning of the 80s. There was some books by Sataputra. There was a very widely distributed magazine called The Origin, like that. But then somehow or another it stopped, and for, I mean, something like 20 years nothing seemed to happen. So then I thought, let's look at, I mean, aren't there more arguments and more scientific work going on against Darwin and theories of evolution and like that? And turns out there was a lot of things going out in the world out there, but some other, you know, no devotees were really getting into that. So then I got into it, and and then I wrote some books, and I've been lecturing on it and writing on it and so on. So so that's what will be the topic of tonight. We'll look at Darwin's theory. We'll look at intelligent design, which how many are aware of the ideas of intelligent design? Yes, no, you are, but not really, because actually there's a whole group of scientists who are arguing for intelligent design nowadays. They are regular scientists, but they say Darwin's theory cannot explain life, and they are arguing instead that life is the result of an intelligent activity, meaning God in some way. Okay, I mean, you cannot say much about who it is, but there is what we see when it comes to life cannot be the result simply of chemistry and physics and chance and evolution over many millions of years. It's simply too complex to explain like that. So there are many scientists now, a minority, and they have been somewhat suppressed, or a lot suppressed, because it's politically incorrect in the modern intellectual world to question the ideas of Darwin and evolution, which means you're questioning atheism and materialism. So that's not allowed, but there are many scientists who are doing it. And so we look at their work, which is completely in line with what Prabhupada actually had in mind for his devotee scientists. It's actually the same kind of work. So here, this is a quote from Srila Prabhupada, just to give an idea about this, that what Prabhupada writes here is, a person who always desires to serve Krishna is interested in ways to convince people that there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna. That is his ambition. So here, this is from a purport in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada is actually pointing out that our preaching mission has is twofold. We should convince people Krishna is God, and God is Krishna. That's one of our mission. But even also, we have to convince people that God exists. And that makes sense, of course, because how can we convince anyone that God is Krishna if people think that God is not there? So we have to also convince people that, you know, God actually does exist. And Prabhupada wanted, also as much our mission. And for that, we need to look at science and scientific arguments, philosophical arguments. You know, Prabhupada, he writes in a purport in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, I think you're familiar with that, where he says, it's kind of a very famous thing, Prabhupada says that religion without philosophy is, you know that?
Sentimentalism.
Yeah. and sometimes fanaticism.
Fanaticism, yeah.
Sentimentalism and sometimes fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is
dry speculation.
Dry speculation, yeah. So, and philosophy also means science. Science is actually, it's in one sense, these are they're just synonyms. In one level, or at least science is part of the bigger field of philosophy. So when Prabhupada says we need science, we need religion with philosophy, it also means we need religion with science. We should also be scientific. So, we can use scientific arguments to argue that God exists. Ultimately, Shastra is our real evidence, but people don't accept Shastra. So then we have to use other arguments to bring to the point of accepting Shastra, which says that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So then we use scientific arguments. So that's the idea. So here again, this is Prabhupada speaking, because they are standing on a wrong theory, all their calculations are wrong and people are suffering. The rascal Darwin's theory, this foolish theory, wrong conception of life. So we have to challenge, protest, defeat. This will be our work. Otherwise, they'll be misleading this society. We have to stop this misleading. So again, Prabhupada is much more, even more emphatic. He called Darwin for a rascal. and that's, and you say, this is not fair. But Prabhupada is pointing out, he and all those who propagate his idea, they're completely misleading whole society, and everyone is suffering because of that. There's so much suffering in this world because people think there's no purpose to life. You know, here in Norway, it's not that because, there's enough money, there's enough material wealth, there's social security, and so on. Everyone has everything, but people are suffering because ultimately I think that life has no purpose, no meaning, and that just, throws you into absolute depression or madness or intoxication or like that. So that is the situation in this world, that people are caught up in this idea that actually there's no purpose to life and life is meaningless. It comes directly from Darwin's theory.
Your life is there to enjoy.
Yeah, that's the idea. But then, and of course we know from Bhagavad Gita, that is the Asura's idea, Asatyam, you know this verse? Asatyam apachistam te.
This was like sarcasm, because the people usually think it's the life is meant to enjoy.
Yeah, but it's
actually the biggest illusion.
Yeah, but the problem is you cannot even enjoy it. Because ultimately. Ultimately, it's just empty, it's.
Yeah, it Krishna. Without Krishna, everything is temporary. This happiness or joy.
The statement was, life is to enjoy. I fully agree.
Yeah, we all agree.
But we need to understand what's the source of enjoyment.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the people think through intoxication that they will be happy. But that is the biggest illusion,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They don't enjoy.
But they think they're enjoying. That's
no.
The problem.
Yeah.
No. But I'm a very precise person. They think they enjoy or they enjoy?
They.
If we are precise, that we can see that they're suffering and they try to ease suffering, they don't enjoy.
The whole material world is a big show and everyone is pretending they're enjoying. Within everyone, each of them think actually something is wrong with me because I see everyone else is so smiling and so happy. So I'd also smile and say, yes, I'm happy, but actually I'm, but that's just to show that actually I'm suffering, but I'm not going to tell anyone. And this way you have the whole... And then some people, they actually, at one point, they break down because you cannot keep up a show for always. And anyway, we all know, we are aware of how much, suffering is in this world, and also people have a hard time being honest about it, but we should at least be very clear about it, that they are suffering like anything. And it goes back to this. As soon as we know that, God exists, I'm eternal, actually, then you're more or less feel happy even in very difficult circumstances. That's all we need to know. So scientists are people after this so-called scientist Darwin. We want to stop this misleading. That is our duty. So that's another quote like that. So for someone may here argue that, you know, Darwin, why, you know, why not others? It's just, is this old man from India is just suffering from an obsession with Darwin or something like that. It's because maybe because he, you know, he was British, and he's, you know, Indians, they hate the British and like that. Maybe something like that. But no, actually, here is a quote from one of the leading scientists in the 20th century, and he was an evolutionary biologist, Ernst Mayr. And he wrote here, "No biologist has been responsible for more and for more drastic modifications of the average person's worldview than Charles Darwin." So this Professor Mayr, he pointed out that actually what, I mean, Darwin stands out amongst all scientists. Other scientists like Einstein, for example, also had a big, big influence within his own field. In Einstein's case, within the world of physics, he changed the world of physics. But he didn't really change, I mean, or his ideas did not affect the rest of the world. The world went on, you know, unaffected by Einstein's theories, but not with Darwin. There was a, you know, he changed the very fabric of the worldview for everyone. He changed the worldview. He changed the way everyone looked at the world, at life. There was a time before Darwin. There was a time after Darwin. He's the most influential scientist, and you might say thinker, in modern time, actually. So I mean that was Mayr's point. And actually, if you look at like kind of the histories of ideas, you can see actually how incredibly influential these ideas came was from that Darwin's ideas were. What Darwin actually did, and this is here another modern scientist, prominent scientist, he wrote here, "Darwin's greatest accomplishment was to show that the complex order and function in living creatures can be explained as a result of a natural process, natural selection, without having to refer to a creator or some other external factor." That's what Darwin really showed. He showed you can explain life without God. That's really when it comes down to it. Someone might say, well, Darwin, I mean, he was neutral to religion, or you should keep God or religion out of discussions on science. Some will say that. But then you have to keep Darwin out, because this is actually what Darwin is discussing, and he's arguing. He's arguing against the idea that you need God or a creator to explain the complexity of life. That's what he's, you know, that's actually his argument. And which is fine in one sense. Darwin has a right to argue like that, but don't argue or don't claim that you cannot discuss whether God is necessary to explain life, because that's what Darwin is arguing. He's arguing against it. But can you argue against it? Then you can also argue for it. I mean, it depends on what is the scientific evidence of what does it, you know, what does it show. So here, this Professor Ayala, he said that Darwin, he showed that you don't have to refer to God, and that became the prominent idea. The world of science before Darwin, scientists, they were actually generally, for the most part, I say 100% part of the real scientists, they were religious, and they were not because they were particularly Christians or like that. They were scientists, and they understood that life and the universe cannot explain itself. You need an intelligent cause behind to explain it. And that was how scientists, they were thinking. And Darwin, he changed that. Somehow or another, he was able, and all his followers were able to change the dominant idea within the world of science, that no, you can explain everything material. That's what Darwin, he did. But before Darwin, actually, scientists, they were, as I say, they were religious. For example, here you see there's a quote from Isaac Newton. Everyone knows Newton. So he wrote in his most famous scientific book, it was called The Principia. It's a book that's packed with mathematical formulas and his mechanics and gravity and motion of planets and so on and so on. But then he also writes in the middle of this whole thing, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. So that was Newton's standard science. And no one was, you know, it's not that that was controversial. It was actually, even some were criticizing Newton, saying actually you know, with all this science, you know, you were arguing for atheism. And Newton said, no, we actually, you know, we're arguing for the existence of God, because, you know, this beautiful order that, you know, I'm discovering in nature can only be explained that by, you know, that God is behind it. And here is another quote, Carl von Linné. Everyone knows him? You don't know? He was the greatest biologist of all time, probably. Swedish. He's the one who made the classification system of biology. Just like, you know, humans are known as Homo sapiens. All species have two Latin names. One for the species, one for the genus, for family. So that's his system, and that's still in use in biology. They say he was the greatest biologist since Aristotle. Aristotle was a biologist also, but then he had to wait for another, at least, you know, almost 2,000 years until he got some on that level. That was Linné, or Linnaeus, as he's known in English. So he wrote also, and this is around in the 1700s, I saw the infinite, all-knowing, and omnipotent God. I followed his footprints over the fields of nature and saw everywhere an eternal wisdom and power and inscrutable perfection. That's what he said. He saw, God's genius everywhere in nature. And here, as late as 1857, this is a Harvard professor, big scientist of his day in the 1800s. He wrote that the living world shows also premeditation, wisdom, greatness, prescience, omniscience, providence. Natural history must in good time become the analysis of the thoughts of the creator of the universe as manifested in the animal and vegetable kingdoms as well as in the inorganic worlds. And I don't know if you can you follow what he says completely? He says anyway that natural history, you can also just say science. Science should become an analysis of the thoughts of God. As you study nature, you study animals and plants and so on, and that should lead you to understand actually what goes on in the mind of God. So that was in 1857. I guess at that time he was among the, you know, might say top five scientists in the world at that time. So 1857 is quite recent. Darwin published his book just 2 years later, actually. So up until the time until Darwin published his book, scientists, they were writing like this. But then, of course, Darwin, he came out with his book on the origin of species by means of natural selection, and somehow that book changed everything. I mean, it's exactly why and so on. Some will say because it's a brilliant book. Maybe it is, but actually it's quite unreadable. Most people, scientists, did not even read it. And his arguments are not that strong if you really look at it. And actually many scientists also were criticizing him like anything. Most scientists actually did not accept it. But still somehow or other it changed. And 10 years later, you know, all the leading scientists, they were thinking like Darwinists. So it's in one sense a big, you know, big question, why, what happens? And I could speak a lot on that, but that's in one sense a little off the, you know, off the point.
I have a question. Did you probably try to search, do the research who found, who were the founding, who was the founder of publications?
Yeah, it depends on what you mean, but scientific publications?
No, who sponsored Darwin?
Yeah, it's well, that has a lot to do with that. Thomas Huxley was one of his real great followers, and he was the one who founded Nature. If you know the journal Nature, it's a leading scientific journal still. Actually, Huxley started this Nature to support to promote Darwin's ideas. So there was a there was some deliverance. There was some conspiracy going on, and they succeeded very well. Did a good job.
They had the knowledge. They used dollars.
Maybe. That I'm not sure. But
I am 100% sure.
Yeah.
I followed the theory. And he belonged to society, eugenic society.
Oh, eugenic society is a little later. It follows in the wake of
officially. Have
stayed their existence in the 20th century. Eugenic was started, at least officially, by Francis Galton, who is a cousin of Darwin. But
officially.
Yeah, I mean this. Of course, I mean this. But there's many phrases going. But anyway, that's beside the point here. But we're looking at the, you know, the ideas, and if they are, you know, are they true or not? How they've been propagated and what's behind, in one sense, is, I mean, it's interesting, but it's because it might be a true idea, even though it's promoted by some conspiracy. But if it's a true idea, then it's true. That doesn't change that. So that's actually what we should be looking at now. Darwin, it changed with Darwin onwards from 1859. In this book, Darwin wrote here, I view all beings not as special creations, but as a lineal descendants of some few beings. Special creation means that living species were created separately, like humans were created separately, monkeys were created separately, elephants were created separately, and pine trees were created separately. That's special creation. Darwin, he argues against that, and he sees instead that we all, he says, lineal descendants, there's common descent. Ultimately, he comes down to the idea that it all started with one simple life form, and over millions of years, this life form, you know, by propagating and multiplicating, diversing, new generations becoming diverse, all, you know, through gradual evolution, all life has arisen. That is Darwin's idea. So, in the origin species, I had two express purposes in mind. First, to show that species can be historically claimed in the same natural selection that the most important cause of change. So, that's what he argues against. Species are not separately created. And natural selection, that means material process. That's Darwin's way of saying that, you know, natural processes, material processes, physics, chemistry can explain everything about life. This is what Darwin is arguing. And thus, he says here, again, Professor Ayala is saying, quote again, Darwin's great accomplishment was to show that the complex order and functioning living creatures can be explained as a result of a natural process, natural selection, without having to refer to a creator or some other external factor. And so that's what he says Darwin showed. Of course, there's a problem with this statement, because Darwin's theory, as he proposed it in The Origin of Species, was actually rejected by scientists, you know, like 1 or 2 decades later, because they actually show that his theory, I mean, didn't work. Darwin had a theory, a particular theory of inheritance, and a theory of how variety would arise, and that was shown that, I mean, his ideas were simply wrong. So actually his ideas, his theory was rejected by scientists. And then later on, a different theory was in kind of created, which is called Neo-Darwinism, which is basically a theory of the 20th century. And that is actually what most evolutionists, all evolutionists today, they're actually Neo-Darwinists, they're not Darwinists. So it's wrong to say that Darwin showed that you can explain the complex order, functional living beings, as a result of a natural process, because he did not show it. He did not show it. So, of course, it's interesting. Scientists disproved his idea, but they did not give up the idea of evolution. It just continued as kind of the belief of science. They didn't revert to the idea that living organisms were specially created. It was just, they just thought, okay, we haven't discovered the mechanism that can explain evolution, but evolution kept hanging kind of there without any real foundation. It's also interesting to observe. But Darwin did not show it. He should show that he can explain complex order through evolution. His idea was rejected. So, look at Darwin just to give an idea of where Darwin was wrong. Darwin had, first of all, an idea that says here species are endlessly mutable through breeding, races, or sorts. Now, through breeding, races or sorts may become new species. I think there's a quote here. Nevertheless, according to my view, varieties are species in the process of formation, or are, as I've called them, incipient species. So just to give you an idea what that means is that Darwin thought that if you breed on animals, you can breed them unlimitedly, and they can change unlimitedly and become new species. And in one, you know, just like on the surface, it might also, you know, look convincing, because actually breeding can cause a lot of change. Like, for example, if you have the dogs, you know, there are dogs which are, you know, very big dogs. Great Danes are some of the biggest dogs, and you have poodles and chihuahuas, and I mean they're so tiny, but actually they come from the same. They come from the same original dog species or wolf species, and just by breeding and, I mean, human selection, you can create dogs of all kinds of varieties, sizes and colors, and you know, fur and shapes, smells and sounds of dogs. But it's all one dog. So if you could, in a few 100 years like that, humans can affect such great changes in the species, then it must be possible to affect much greater changes over millions of years. Hi, Kristen. When there is also some natural selection ongoing on in nature through the survival of the fittest. So that was Darwin's idea. Nevertheless, it's clearly a wrong idea. It doesn't work like that. And Darwin even should have known that, because you can be breeding, but all breeders will know that you reach a point and then you cannot cause more changes, actually. And that's not something that, it has been discovered later on, Hutchinson. That has been discovered. It's not something that only has been discovered or shown later on, something that was known before, because breeding is not a new idea. Humans have been breeding at least for a few thousand years in recorded history, and we know, of course, much longer, but at least in the recorded history, official history, at least for the last couple of thousand years, we have been breeding on animals and plants. So, and we know the mechanisms, and you simply cannot push beyond a certain limit. Here is a quote. This is from a plant breeder, Luther Burbanks, in his writing around 1900. I know from experience that I can develop a plum half an inch long or one 2.5 inches long with every possible length in between, but I'm willing to admit that it's hopeless to try to get a plum the size of a small pea or one as big as a grapefruit. I have roses that bloom pretty steadily for 6 months of the year, but I have none that will bloom 12, and I will not have. In short, there are limits to the development possible. So you get the point. It's Darwin is wrong on that one.
If you just go back one slide, if we change only one word in Darwin's story, because I was meditating, why is so many people so easily accept his theory? So if we just change from species to conscious living being,
yeah, but that we don't,
endlessly mutable, that it's exactly the Vedic knowledge that we have.
But here we just, you know, conscious as a separate thing we don't even discuss right now. That might believe that that's not relevant right now. We're looking at the idea, similarly at biology, meaning matter in itself. So that's what we should just focus on that. And Darwin's second mistake was to think that acquired traits are inherited. I know that sounds cryptic, doesn't it? I mean, here I'll give you a couple of quotes so you get an idea what we're talking about here. The great and inherited development of the udders and cows and goats in countries where they are habitually milked, in comparison to the state of these organs in other countries, is another instance of the effect of use that causes changes in the organisms. Darwin is claiming that, I mean, if you milk cows, then as a result, a cow will get a greater udder, you know, that you can observe. And then he thinks that is inherited. That means he thinks that the calves of that cow will be born with greater udders. That's what he was arguing. Another quote: from the facts alluded to in the first chapter, I think there can be little doubt that use in our domestic animals strengthens and enlarges certain parts, and disuse diminishes them, and that such modifications are inherited. You understand what he's saying?
Back to the last picture of the thinking man, is that what they would say today is epigenetics?
Epigenetics is a...
Because if you, for instance, they have, if the parents are starving for a longer period, or a child has been starving for a longer period,
mm-hmm.
Next, they will see that in the next generation, that the next generation of kids, of children, will put on weight much easier, for instance. But so I don't know. Is that something that will?
I mean, actually, really, what Darwin has is idea of a much earlier scientist called Lamarck, French Lamarck, who had the idea exactly like, for example, if you have giraffes, how does a giraffe get a long neck? And his idea was simple, that if, you know, we have some kind of deer that is stretching to reach leaves which no other species can reach, and he gets a longer neck, then he'll get a calf that has a longer neck. That's kind of that's Lamarck's idea. Darwin takes, you know, inherits this idea from Lamarck. So that was basically shown to be wrong from what they could observe. Mendel came out and showed the laws of inheritance, I'll have a little more on that. But basically shown that inheritance means that you have the same material being passed on from generation to generation to generation without change. Like, let's see here. Yeah. Epigenetics is that's one of the latest in the, like, come up with, like, in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And there seems to be something that can you can pass on, but not in the simple way that Darwin thought. And also, in accident, it makes things even more difficult to explain by evolution, because a lot of the epigenetics is actually some, you know, it's inheritance that is not stored in genes. Genes is that was discovered that genes are,
you know, change
genes.
Yeah.
No, you cannot change genes. Genes are steady.
But that's what the epigenetics says.
No,
they turn off and on. So the genes they turn off and on special. I don't know. Can't remember what the word was. And then after a while the genes will be changing.
Yeah, but the genes are the same. Of course, it's, you can have control genes that control other genes, and genes can be turned on and off. But the genes themselves don't change, except if they have mutations. But also epigenetics, and it's something that they really are researching. They're discovering that there is a lot of inheritance, like you say, coded on not only on the DNA and the chromosomes, but actually even on the cell wall and in many other parts of the cell. And they seem to be affected, because that part is actually is only passed on from mother to child, because the male only leaves, you know, the mother gives provides a whole cell, and but the father only, you know, gives a sperm cell, a little, you know, he actually only provides some DNA. The mother gives a whole cell in the egg. So on this cell from the mother, there's on the cell walls and so on, there's actually a lot of inheritance also. And that seems to be affected also. It's quite complicated, and scientists nowadays don't have any complete overview of what goes on. It's kind of a complete emerging new field.
Yeah.
But the overall still, I mean the overall inheritance is still, I mean, it definitely does not work like what Darwin he said. It's not that if I, for instance, I go to like bodybuilding, I really exercise hard and I get big strong muscles, and then I'll get a son that has bigger muscles. It doesn't work like that. Or if I, you know, if you know, us white skinned people, we move to, you know, to India, like a hot country, and we live for many years in the sun, and we get become beautiful, brown, tanned like that. But our children will not be born like with brown skin color. Or like, for example, you have in some cultures, women, they make themselves even more beautiful by enlarging their, for example, their lips or their ears or their noses by hanging things in them, and then. But the girls born in those cultures, they don't look different from girls in any other culture. So that does not happen. It was discovered by another scientist at the same time of Darwin, Gregor Mendel, Austrian. He was actually a monk in a monastery in Austria, and he was experimenting with, especially with plants, peas. He was crossing different kinds of peas, and he was discovering that actually inheritance means that you actually have this constant set of of genes or genetic material. And then you mix it, and then you create all kinds of varieties by mixing. But you don't create new genetic material. It's like you have a deck of cards, and then you can mix the cards, and then you can hand out cards. So you can have different varieties of hands or combination of these cards. But Darwin's idea is that actually, if you mix cards, you create new cards. That was actually Darwin's idea. But then again, inheritance is extremely complex. There is the new field of epigenetics. There's more to it also. Consciousness also affects the body and so on. We know that. But, I mean, it's... yeah. For... I mean, just for at least this presentation, which is still standard biology, Mendel's ideas are still standard. Definitely Darwin's idea about inheritance are wrong, and that's why his ideas were rejected. And Darwinists or evolutionists became neo-Darwinists in a later, you know, in a later age, where Darwinism meant that species are endlessly mutable. External influences and use of organs create new genetic material and acquired traits are inherited. And that idea was rejected already around 1875. So actually, when you meet people who say they believe in Darwin, you can tell them, no, you don't believe in Darwin. And, you're a neo-Darwinist. And probably already told them more than they know, including many top biologists are not even aware of this distinction. But neo-Darwinism is the idea that genetic mutations create new genes which ultimately make it rise to new species and otherwise stable species. It's the idea of mutations. This is not Darwin. Many think that Darwin talks about mutations, but that's not it's a later word. Mendel discovered that inheritance just means you're passing on constant traits from generation to generation. But then they observed that, yeah, that happens. But then again, somehow or another, something, there is a sudden change anyway, sometimes. And these changes were called freaks of nature to start with. And later on, they were called mutations. And when DNA and or the structure of DNA was discovered in the 1950s, it was discovered that these mutations, they're actually copying errors on the DNA when the cell are dividing themselves and copying themselves, and the DNA is being copied to a new strain of DNA. And sometimes there are mistakes in the copying of DNA, and that's a mutation. So neo-Darwinists are thinking that the genetic mutations, they create new genes, new variety. And that gives rise to new species. Because also you have to understand that really what is needed is not just natural selection or survival of the fittest, but you have to explain how new variety comes about. Where does it come from? Is that clear? Because selection just means like, for example, that you have some kind of antelopes. Or you have some antelopes. Some can run fast, some can run slow. And then natural selection is that the lions, they catch the ones that run slow, and the fast ones, they escape the lions. So gradually you end up only with very fast running antelopes. So that's fine, but that does not explain how antelopes, they arose in to begin with. Is that, selection actually means you reduce, it doesn't increase, it reduces the variety. But where does the variety come from in the first place? That's what they really have to explain. And so that's neo-Darwinist idea, that these mutations, they give rise to new genes, which can give rise to new species ultimately. So what about that idea? Does that actually explain the complex order and structure of living organisms? There are reasons to think they don't. Mutations, of course, do cause something. I mean, the mutations are there. Nobody is. I mean, everyone knows there are mutations, and they can give rise to something. For example, you might see some would argue that parasites become resistant to antibiotics through mutation. That can happen. There are even some fish that develop some antifreeze proteins, so they can live in temperatures way below zero. There's some species of fish in around the Antarctic like that, and that seems to be able to also evolve by some natural selection, but no, by through mutations and natural selection. But when it comes down to it, there are very few examples of favorable mutations creating, or just of mutations being favorable and moving a species forward. And one example you sometimes see has something to do with malaria. This is malaria parasites. But the example I'm thinking of here is that some people have a mutation that gives them a disease that is called sickle cell anemia. And you know, for the most part, our blood cells for normal human beings are a spherical round. But those who have this particular mutation, their blood cells are spherical, like half moon blood cells. And it's actually it's a mutation, and actually it's not, you cannot really say it's a really beneficial mutation, because something like 20% or 25% of those with that disease actually die from it. So how can you say it's a favorable mutation? But it turns out that those who have sickle cell anemia, actually they're resistant to malaria. So in areas where like maybe 40% of people die from malaria, those who have sickle cell anemia, they survive better. And therefore you see certain parts of Africa, large percentage of population have sickle cell anemia, because they were selected in, you know, because of malaria. So, but then again, can you really say this was a favorable mutation? And actually there are very few exams like that of favorable mutations. Doctors have, you know, big books on mutations and the diseases they cause, but favorable mutations are very, very few. Or you can also, if you look at, again, at this malaria parasite, then it's interesting. Here is a map. It's showing the areas in the world where you find malaria, different kinds of malaria. And you'll see that it's they're all in the tropics. Malaria is a tropical disease. So you can ask, of course, why is it only in the tropics? And the reason is, it turns out, that the malaria parasites cannot survive and propagate when the temperature drops below 16.5 degrees centigrade. You know, malaria's parasites, they live in humans, and mosquitoes, like, this is their life cycle. There's a whole life cycle, and it takes place in humans and in mosquitoes. So humans, of course, are warm-blooded. There they can, you know, thrive real well. But in mosquitoes, they're cold-blooded, so they have the temperature, adopt the temperature of the environment. So when the temperature drops to below 6.5, they suddenly die out. And that's why you only have them in the tropics. So then you could ask, why is it that these parasites have not developed tolerance to lower temperatures than 6.5 degrees centigrade through mutations? Because it would seem that they had plenty of opportunity to do so, because there have been more malaria parasites and more generations of parasites in the last 10,000 years than has been generations of mammals over the last 100 million years. And the theory, new Darwinistic theory, is that through mutations and natural selection, all mammals rose from some kind of a simple rat-like creature and became elephants and whales and bats and thousands of other mammals and humans and so on. So how can it be that these parasites couldn't develop something quite simple, but, you know, compared to that, if they have so much more opportunity? But it turns out actually that in order to actually develop tolerance to a lower temperature, these parasites would have to have more mutations, would have to happen simultaneously in one individual than is likely to ever happen, even with such a staggering number of parasites which actually have been there. You understand? Follow the point? Somewhat? A bit.
My English is also very good. So.
What don't you understand?
Many things, actually.
Okay.
It's quite difficult, actually.
It is? Okay. I'm glad to see that. I'm glad I asked. I'll go through, and then we take some questions afterwards.
Don't take questions.
Huh?
So, so. You still not be able to answer.
Okay.
At least me.
No, no, but you should ask me questions. I'm not talking about. But here, the argument is simply that to develop tolerance to a lower temperature is quite a simple thing compared to evolve from being a rat to a whale, or from a rat to a monkey or something like that. Much, but species will have been many, many more individuals, you know, could not develop tolerance to something to a lower temperature. So with less individuals, less you know, generations, you know, how could so many big differences happen there? Things, that's the argument that puts a whole big question mark on the idea that the evolution of mammals, you know, mammals, what mammals are? Yeah, pattedyr. You are a mammal and I'm also. Mammals are all species that have mothers that give milk. Like you have, you know, you have birds, that's another variety. You have reptiles,
yeah.
And you have mammals.
Okay.
So that's what we are. We are mammals.
Thank you.
Good, Amish. <amazing. laughs> So, yeah. And actually there are many, I mean, this whole theory of Neo-Darwinism has actually many problems. So much so that actually you can go on the internet. You can find there's a whole list here where more than 800 top scientists they have minimum PhD, they are they are hired at big universities, they are biologists, physicists, chemists, biochemists, geologists. They have to be scientists in one of the so-called hard sciences, so they have Okay, I'll do it. So so they have signed this statement here. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of this, the evidence for Darwinian theories should be encouraged. So, and actually, this whole idea of Neo-Darwinism to be strictly correct, is actually very debated nowadays. In 2008, of course, that's 10 years ago, time moves very fast, but in 2008 this institute in Austria, which is a world famous institute of evolution and biology, they invited some of the leading biologists of the world to a conference called Toward an Extended Evolutionary Synthesis, and they explained the conference in the invitation they sent out. They wrote, not only we have witnessed the molecular revolution from the discovery of the structure of DNA to the genomic era, we are also grappling with the increasing feeling that we just don't have the theoretical and analytical tools necessary to make sense of the bewildering diversity and complexity of living organisms. I don't know if it makes complete sense, but what's interesting, this is up here, we just don't have the theoretical tools necessary to make sense of the complexity of living organisms. So that's 2008. You remember I quoted this Ayala. He said, Darwin explained or showed how you can explain the complex order of living organisms by natural process. But here scientists say we don't have theoretical tools, might just say a theory. It's just, you know, so they could just say we don't have a theory that can explain the complexity of living organisms. This is actually the situation when the scientists speak amongst themselves. And the problem is actually biochemistry and molecular biology. It is discoveries of what is going on inside a cell, something that has been discovered from this 1960s and onwards especially. And inside the cell, scientists have discovered a world of an astounding complexity that, you know, has no parallel to anything in nature. I have a film clip here about what goes on inside the cell. I'm a little unsure if it starts, otherwise I have to go and do something. Let's see here.
No matter how
stop.
Life began, on the backs of crystals or in the test tube of some intelligent designer, everyone agrees it started with a single cell. But what is a cell? Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Darwin wrote The Origin of Species in 1859, published it in 1859. He had an idea of the cell as being quite simple, correct?
Yeah, everybody did.
Yeah, okay. If he thought of the cell as being a Buick, what is the cell now in terms of its complexity by comparison?
A galaxy.
If Darwin thought a cell was, say, a mud hut, what do we now know that a cell is?
More complicated than a Saturn V.
So what is in a cell as far as we know now?
A world that Darwin never could have imagined.
I needed someone who could give me a glimpse into this world. So we went to molecular biologist Doug Axe.
Think of a cell as being a nanofactory, a factory where, on a very small scale, digital instructions are being used to make the components of the factory. Here we have the famous DNA double helix. You can see the two helical strands that are intertwined and wind around each other on the outside of the molecule. This is the material that stores all of our genetic information. In higher life forms, this will be the equivalent of something like a gigabyte of information stored in the molecules that form the individual chromosomes, all packed within the nucleus, which is a tiny fraction of the entire cell size. So what does DNA do? Well, the information in DNA ends up providing the information for sequencing amino acids to make protein. We have information in a one-dimensional form that provides the information for a three-dimensional form.
Now you see what goes on inside the cell here, just to get an idea.
Replication, quality control, and repair? What if these new mechanisms have massive design implications? Well, I say, so be it.
So, it has some Danish subtitles. So, that's actually the big, big problem confronting biology and evolution today. So, explain the complexity on the molecular level. Inside the cell, what has been discovered is that actually cells, as I said, are the most complex thing found anywhere in nature. Just one single cell is more complex than, for example, the whole city of Oslo. There are millions of processes going on. It's a world of every second, around 1,000 new molecular machines are created every second in one cell. So many things going on. There are robots, molecular robots, and
And I was also thinking about what they're saying about cells now, that every cell is also consciousness.
But that I'll leave out for now, if it's okay.
Okay.
Consciousness is. Ultimately, our argument is about consciousness, but
yeah.
This is. Let's leave that out.
Okay.
Let's leave that out. But also what's interesting is that cells are actually ultimately based on digital technology. the DNA and the whole information written on DNA, which is what is actually the cell is you know springing out from the information on the DNA is a computer code, like a computer code, just much much more advanced. I mean, our computers, as we saw here, is based on a information system of ones and zeros, binary information. But the cell has a four-digit information system, extremely advanced. And you know, so how can you explain where does that come from? The real fact is that scientists have no material explanation for where that came from on the early Earth. That's a problem that's really confronting biologists nowadays. Here is a quote.
Shouldn't we say the mainstream scientists?
Yeah, that's mainstream scientists, yeah.
Because I follow science for like 15 years, and I know in Prabhupada times, and actually Prabhupada says that we were taught in a school. I born in a communist country,
mm-hmm.
but I was attending, I was not going to school in a big city. I was attending to school in a small city,
mm-hmm.
so we never, nobody questioned God, even
no.
on the lessons of biology, nobody dares do it,
no.
because everybody, Poland is a very religious country, so...
Right, yeah. So like, but here in Scandinavia is something else.
I learned about the Darwin implication only when I started to
come to
meet with devotees.
Yeah. yeah.
They
yeah.
told me that
yeah.
Darwin's theory gave a big impression on the science.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in Poland.
Not in Poland, I'm sure. And here in the Western countries, Scandinavia a lot. Actually, the whole world, Western world, England, of course, Darwin was there, America like anything. Even India. Also in India it's big.
I thought that it's not allowed to teach the Darwin theory in schools in the States.
Oh yeah, they do that like anything.
No, there are some states where it's not.
No, it's not correct. I mean, they had some back in the 1930s, there were some court cases and kind of it was stopped, but nowadays they teach it like anything. It is just a standard science.
Oh.
Yeah, there's no one. No, it's the other way around. Some states, they want to introduce some criticism of Darwinism also,
mm-hmm.
and they'll not allow that. They'll not allow that.
I thought that at least like in Utah, where there are a lot of Mormons and stuff,
but not in the official schools.
Okay.
Not in the official schools. And they, and what they do is that they say you have to keep religion out. You have to be secular and be neutral to religion. Which means, but they interpret that you have to keep religion completely out. And as soon as you criticize Darwin, then you must introduce some kind of a idea of a creator. And then say, now we introduce religion, that cannot enter our schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's not America. Is you have some private schools, biblical schools, that's a different thing.
Mm.
But public schools, it's all Darwin all the way.
Maybe like in the Muslim countries, because they are hardcore believers in God.
That's a different story, yeah.
That would be nice. So
Darwin is not really being taught.
They're not the West.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here where we are living,
yeah.
in our...
It's taken over here.
Yeah. It's... Darwinism is standard here. It's been standard here, especially in Scandinavia, for the last more than 100 years. For example, did you mention eugenic movement?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Scandinavian countries were the biggest in eugenics.
What is that?
Eugenic movement is the idea that you have to also breed, you know, on humans, especially since you know, in order to protect the evolution of humans. One thing is breeding, but you have to at least ensure that those with weak genes are not allowed.
Bad genome.
Yeah, they cannot be allowed to propagate, get children. which is like if you have a, for example, cows, then you try to combine a cow and a bull with a strong cow, strong bull. You don't let a weak and sickly cow or a weak bull mate with a cow. So that's kind of, you breed with your animals. So the idea came that should also apply to humans, and otherwise the evolution of the human species would revert and we become weak as a species and die out or something like that.
That's a narcissistic, no?
Yeah. Nazis were ended up, they were just the extreme. That was when it went really wild. But Nazis were just, it was mainstream again in whole Europe, whole Scandinavia was like that. And it was actually
in the 80s in the United States, they were allowed.
Yeah.
A woman was black from Mexico. She went to the hospital for just routine treatment.
Yeah.
They immediately put her to sleep, and they just make a standard sterilization.
Yeah. The sterilization became very prominent. In Denmark, the law was finally abolished in 1970 in Denmark.
1970.
Yeah, that was when it was
abolished. Did it
abolished.
Do it all up to that?
Probably. It wasn't. They didn't write us talk a lot about, but kind of hidden hospitals and mental hospitals. So a lot of retarded people were sterilized, but also, even just those who were misfits. That it was kind of, how do you actually assess who is intelligent, who is not intelligent? Misfits, they were kind of, they're also sterilized. And it came also out that in some places, those who were of a different, like in America, a lot of the American Indians, they were sterilized. And probably also black and Mexicans, but no American Indians, there were a number of them, many of them were sterilized. Even the political deviants, individuals, they were also sterilized, because also they were misfit. I mean, Denmark, I think, sterilized 60,000 people.
Wow.
And Norway, even, just as many in Norway. Norway was really bad on that. America, California was, I think that was the worst place, but it was all over. And it was standard. It was Darwinian idea. We have to, and it ended up with, of course, the Nazis. They discovered that, why spend time sterilizing them? It's better just kill them. So all these racial ideas, they go back to Darwin. That's a whole eugenic movement. It's really, it's kind of forgotten, or because it's really an embarrassing thing. But that was going on. So that was there. So we're talking about, you say maybe Poland. Okay, maybe Poland, a place like that, were exceptions. But here in the West, Darwinism is. And Nazism was ultimate. Hitler was a Darwinist. When he talks about Mein Kampf, what is the Kampf actually talking about? This is actually his struggle for existence. Let's go back to Darwin. This is what he's referring to by Mein Kampf. And
he was using Vedic symbols.
He's a mix of all things, and he's not even really aware that ideas come from Darwin. In that sense, he's not consciously, but it's just they are there circulating, and Hitler picks up things from here and there. And ultimately,
what? To be a top topic, but I was I did a huge research on a whole movement which starts in the 18th century when the people start to get knowledge, and they start to propagate, but only on the elite level, and they try to use all the Vedic wisdom in a demoniac way.
Mm.
And they say, we have to develop understanding and just turn all the world against God.
Right.
So instead of using Vedic wisdom to worship God, they just manipulate whole world to turn it to the animal level. Like they deprive, like when you travel, keep quotations from Darwin, it's like a huge manipulation. Some of them, I feel like they almost taken from the Vedas. They just change the names.
Prabhupada said, Dharma had the idea of evolution from the Vedas, where we talk about evolution from consciousness. And so, but in any case, on this level, when we are, I mean, first of all, we are addressing maybe some doubts many devotees have because of science, and also we are, you know, reaching out to, for example, students and so on who are just, you know, influenced by science. We keep it on this level here, you know, keep the Vedas. It becomes, because I say in one sense, it's even irrelevant. The point is it true or not? Not who has, you know, the history where the idea comes from, like that. It might be a true idea. The real point we have to discuss that, and as you find out, it's not a true idea. It's a false idea. Just like,
just a question, because this is from 2008, and they said this statement before they had the conference.
Yeah.
Couldn't one assume that at least they come up with some better theory now?
No. Don't have that. You can the mystery of the origin of life. I'll just go to the next quote here. That's from 1998. That's 20 years back. Today, as we leave the 20th century, we still face the biggest unsolved problem that we had when we entered the 20th century. How did life originate on Earth? So that's a big scientist 20 years ago who said that. But I haven't updated this presentation for some years. It's still the same. It hasn't changed. They still have no, not even an idea of what a theory should look like that could explain the origin of life, to explain life as we know it now.
They don't admit it, of course.
Yeah, maybe not like, you know, official statements, but then you look at, you know, individual scientists. There you find it's stated all over. Like this is an individual scientist writing like that. They actually do admit it, but then when they confront it, then they will say it's fact. Evolution is a fact. It's proof. It's like that.
Can you say that they're like false prophets, like that?
Yeah, they're false prophets, false leaders, false intellectuals, false Brahmins.
Yeah. 2011, Nassim
Harane. Who?
Nassim Harane. I have suggestion to do the research. He won the first prize in Belgium. There was a mathematical, not contest, like, I don't have a proper word, the name. Conference, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He won the first prize because he created equation, mathematical equation, proving existence of God.
Yeah.
And it was even printed in scientific magazines, in mathematical, I don't remember the title of the magazine. So there is a theory, mathematical theory, proving existence of God. So
maybe you can show it to me. And but he's not the only one. I mean, you can make calculations. Even I can give you some calculations that show the improbability of life arising on its own. And that only, it's not even so difficult to make calculations like that. But, you know, what happened to them? They just ignored. There was one conference back in 1966 where some of the leading mathematicians met with some of the leading evolutionary biologists on a big conference. It was called Mathematical Challenges of Neo-Darwinian Theory. Had a big conference in Pennsylvania. And the mathematicians, they were presenting this. I mean, you look at the, for example, development of the eye, and like that, you know, probability speaks against it. It's simply not. There's not enough, you know, cannot be enough mutations. Cannot be enough. Life is not, you know. They showed it, and how did the biologists react? Well, they say something is wrong with your mathematics. We don't know, but I mean, that's because we know one thing we're sure of: evolution is a fact. Evolution happens, and so something's wrong with your numbers. So we have to figure it out, and then when we get find out, then we'll be all right. But we are, you know, it's actually this Ernst Mayr, he was there at us started with. He said, "Be comforted by the fact be comforted by the fact that evolution has happened." That's it. So you present these, it doesn't change there. It's ultimately it's not really. I mean, to disprove evolution is quite simple. You know, it's all there and it's been done again and again and again. The point is to get it out. It's a war, not only of proofs and arguments and evidence, but it's a rhetorical war and it's a propaganda war that goes on. And that's the yeah. So these, but we have to be convinced ourselves and know the arguments.
Just one question. I've been thinking about this. I mean, who maybe theoretically understand that they may make a scheme that animal life has evolved, but what about the thing about the plant life? How can plant life be? Was that like a different kind of evolution going on at the same time as the?
At one point it was started out with a single cell creature that was, you can say, neither plant, animal, or whatever it is. And at one point they diverged, and one diverged into the animal kingdom, and one diverged and became.
I think they call it primordial soup or something.
That's before the first cell is there. But that's an old idea now. That's because you have to have the first cell. So where does that come from? So that comes from, some early organic chemicals. It's completely theoretical. When you look for what they call this primordial soup, there's no geological evidence of ever being an ocean of primordial soup anywhere. So it's just a theoretical idea they have. But what you're talking about is after that. You're talking about after life supposedly have risen on its own and start evolving, and then they diverge at one point. Plants go this direction, animals go this direction.
They say it's only two different things, plants and animals.
Yeah, they're talking now about, I think they have five kingdoms. If you talk, there's an animal kingdom and the vegetable kingdom. But also you have bacteria is a kingdom. And
fungus?
Yeah, what is that called? Algae. Algae is their own kingdom. Actually, bacteria turn out to have two kingdoms. What's called the archaea is one kingdom, and I'm not sure, but there's bacteria have two kingdoms. So, but then of course, then you have a paradox. That you have many similarities even amongst plants and animals. If they rose independently, how can they have similarities? One similarity is many plants also are divided into male and female individuals, and they have to combine. You know, flowers are like that. They have their male organs, they have female organs, and male cells and female cells. So that's quite a complex thing. So did that arise twice independently? That's very unlikely. But they're supposed to have diverged before that trait was there. So that's a big thing of called convergence. They call it that.
So did we just appear like this?
Just
as humans, just like.
Oh.
Or have we just always been humans, or did it like just appear?
That's a separate question, a separate issue. In one sense, we're just looking at what cannot be true. What is true?
Huh? True.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, I could. You know, we can definitely give. You know, there's. You know, of course, then you can come up with different ideas, but the Vedas are very specific. Of course, then you would have to really go before you say where do humans come from. Ultimately, come down to also you have maybe at first you should ask what is a human and what is life. and there you have to come to discussing consciousness and how we know this body. I mean, this whole, you know, presentation will end up with that also. And before we actually understand that we are, you know, conscious beings and different from the body and like that, we cannot really. I mean, we can, but to make complete sense, then that has to be part of that also. But just to show, yes, humans have always been there. Humans have always been here. Millions and millions and millions of years. Actually, as long as there's been life, there have been humans. I'll give you tomorrow, Forbidden Archaeology. The first presentation is about human beings like us from millions and millions and millions of years back. Archaeological evidence showing there has been humans like us from hundreds of millions of years. But that's going to take too long to answer that question right now. That's okay. I think I'm winding up more or less. This is another quote about the origin of life from one famous Cambridge scientist. An abject scientific failure. It was in a chapter in a book that I wrote where we talked about research into the origin of life. It's just a failure. Abject means miserable or pathetic. It's just, you know, science has gone and made no progress in understanding the origin of life over 50 years. And yeah, another quote like that. And I mean, I could just keep on giving you quotes. In other words, when you talk about evolution, there's no theory of evolution today. It's not even a question of evolution if it's true or not. The real point is there is no theory of evolution. So what is it?
It's a religion.
It's a written, it's a belief, it's a faith. It's a creation myth that is being propagated everywhere. The other creation myth, you know, God, you know, created everything 5,000 years ago over 6 days. He rested on the seventh day. That's a creation myth. This is another creation myth. And because there's a whole religion supporting this creation myth, therefore there's such resistance to when you actually are criticizing it. But that's also why probably he wanted it criticized. What did you not understand? Or is it? Can you follow somewhat?
Yeah, something. I understand some things.
Okay.
More similar things.
Yeah.
But then it's like very deep, so then.
Montes is not deep, it's just technical.
Yeah, but there's some words.
It's just the technical words.
Yeah,
and that's why often you get lost when you talk with scientists like that you use technical slang, which sounds like they're very learned and intelligent, and you're very stupid because you don't understand these words. But it's actually, in one sense, it's very simple. Prabhupada put it in very simple words, and it is that simple. And the words is also, I mean, we can also impress people, you know, when we speak about Krishna consciousness, we use a lot of Sanskrit. People that just lost, they think we're very intelligent. But in one sense, that's bluffing. That's really bluffing. You know, if you'd be able to actually really understand a topic, and you're a good teacher, you can actually also explain it with simple words so even a child can understand. You don't need to use these technical words. Of course, tendency is, I've dealt so much, so I kind of just take it for granted that everyone understands technical words like that. But it's, many don't. But still, it's not complicated, this.
I'm sorry, but I kind of fell out when you spoke about these mosquitoes and like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you made a point about these mosquitoes. Let me just see if I somehow will catch
it. It wasn't mosquitoes, it was malarial parasites.
Oh, sorry.
But malaria is caused by a parasite that enters your body, and then it starts multiplying in the body, and it attacks the blood cells. That's malaria. And but then it is when it is spread by mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, they, you know, bites one human, sucks some blood, and then flies off and bites another human, and then the parasite is transferred from one individual to another individual. That's where the mosquitoes enter. Mosquitoes themselves are not causing it, they're simply transporting parasites from one human to another human.
Yeah, and then you made a point about this, that some or other they couldn't survive
when the
temperature change?
Yeah, when the parasites are outside of the human body, then they're out in the open, because mosquitoes are cold-blooded. You know, cold-blooded, warm-blooded?
Not really.
Okay. You are warm-blooded. Mammals are warm-blooded. That means your body temperature is always the same. 37.1 or something like that, isn't it? Okay. So, because there is a, you have your own internal heating system that keeps a steady temperature in the body. But I mean, so we have that. Mammals have that. We are mammals. Birds have that. But reptiles, and that means lizards and what I mean, all the reptiles. All the and what is it? Huh?
Snakes.
Yeah, snakes. Snakes are reptiles, and frogs and toads. They are what? Not reptiles. What is the other one? Paddle.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? They're cold blooded, and insects are cold blooded. They have no. So that means when the temperature.
Toads and
frogs.
Frogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Padder in Danish. Padder. Yeah. What's that in English?
Toads.
Huh?
Toads. Isn't it?
No, the whole, you know.
The whole spectrum.
Yeah, the whole order.
Okay.
Just
skip on
me. Huh?
Toad family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Polish was.
Huh?
Was.
Prussian. Yeah.
Polish.
I mean, we should. So. So the point is they are, so, and that's why you see, for example, snakes, when it gets cold, they become very slow and very, you know, and when they become warm, then suddenly they're alive and like that. Lizards are the same also.
And we also, you and so, we're also affected by the warmth,
no? No, not this, I mean, we can, our body temperature is, I mean, of course we're affected, but we are, nevertheless, we're warm-blooded.
So even though
my temperature
stays the same, even in the
internet
as well?
No, that can, I mean, you can heat up and get heat strokes, that's another point. We don't have any.
Yeah,
I don't.
If your temperature goes way up or way down, then you get ill.
Yeah.
I don't think we have. Your body can't take big temperature changes.
We don't have built in AC, but we have a heating system. Somewhat.
So
but of course, if you go out and it's minus 20 and you stay out long enough, you will freeze to death anyway. But not as fast as frogs or lizards or like that.
So they are more affected by the weather changes.
Yeah.
That's the point.
And the point is that mosquitoes, when the temperature drops, then the parasites, they die out. Mosquitoes can still survive to lower temperatures, but not the parasites. Simple point.
Yeah, and then how is that connected to the whole thing?
Why haven't the parasites developed tolerance through mutations to lower temperatures? You know, because these parasites, there are so many. You know, just one human that has malaria has billions of parasites inside his body.
Really?
Yeah, they're microbes. I mean, a little bit bigger than bacteria, but they're
very... Just one mosquito, billions.
Yeah, one parasite. Because they multiply. They divide and become many. And
they're still not able to mutate to be ready to survive
lower temperatures. That's the point. Why is it that if, you know, there has been less mammals for more than 100 million years than there has been parasites for the last 10,000 years.
Can't you just say parasites is totally different species? They don't operate.
It does not do with different species. They also are mutating. They're propagating, there's, you know, and they're copying their DNA, their mutations. That happens
but
all
do
over.
Do they really change that much? The parasites, maybe they don't change so much.
No, they don't. That's the point.
Can't you just say that's kind of normal because it's a totally different species?
No, but the mechanism of, you know, how the chromosomes are being copied and the DNA is being copied, that's the same. That's the same for, you know, that's the same for all living species, all cells, whether they are insects or parasites or humans or mammals or birds or lizards or plants or bacteria, anything like that. So that's the same. Cells are the foundation for everything, for all living organisms. Anyway,
so they have a theory of humans that are mutated a whole lot, and these are not mutating at all. So that's kind
of that comes out like that. That they must have, you know, we were able to change so much from some original. I think that the first mammal was something like a rat or rat-like thing.
A rat?
Oh, rat. Some kind of rat-like creature.
So we're coming from rats. That's their theory.
Something like that. Something like that. And that.
Goes out of the water.
Huh?
It goes out of the water.
A rat coming out of the water.
Nonsense. So you should try to make a sense of it.
That's a good
it's
religion.
Not possible.
Yeah.
So because it's pure appetite. It's like the best way to understand it is ask who pay for it. And I realized in 1760 they create a secret society which arranged money. It was governed by four big families: Bauer, MacDonald, Carnegie. I don't remember the fourth name. They become very influential because they start to speculate in a stock market. And then they realize, okay, we can control all the world through money. So this is why we got, for example, modern medicine. It's completely sponsored by a guy who's a CEO, who's the owner of the big pharmaceutical companies.
Oh, yeah.
So whole medicine is just a super to sell pills for everything.
Yeah.
So it cannot work because this is just business. Like, for example, they found hundreds of years ago, when they start to research cancer, they know it's just a mushroom in the body. But now it's like, instead of changing diet, they promote chemistry, which is extremely, not only dangerous, but it's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It costs like, you know, 400,000 kroners to pay one treatment. So this is business.
Yes.
And we're just like, we're like cattle. They don't even consider that we're humans.
Mm-hmm.
We're just numbers. And they make the money of us.
Yeah. So that's going on. So therefore we have to understand falsehood from truth. You know, separate that. So we're trying to do that, and you know, and Prophet wanted, you know, people to become enlightened, not stop at this only, but that's the first step. Then, of course, you can accept afterwards. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, whole thing, philosophy like that. But that more questions on this so far.
I just wonder, you've been maybe presenting this to not only devotees, but to schools or
many contexts.
Have you never been challenged about this thing?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You're quite blunt in it.
Yeah.
People have been angry at you and said that.
Oh! I try to deal with people in a way so they don't really become angry, but sometimes I have been very disturbed. Yeah. And you cannot really change their mind. They have their someone who's really, you know, really stuck in a certain way of looking at things cannot, you know, you present proofs, know, complete clear evidence. They cannot see it. They can, but those who are simply open-minded like that, they will say, oh, this makes sense. I had one example. I was actually in South Africa once and giving lectures on this. And you remember that you were in Copenhagen that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So was in the Pretoria. The whole biology department came out to my presentation there,
sure.
And it was fun. You know, I gave basically this one. I mean, this is. I mean, there's some Prabhupada quotes. I don't have that. I mean, this is more made for devotees, but something that's along the same lines. And of course, they were very, you know, they were quite. When can we get a chance to say something like that? So as soon as it was over, I asked some questions, and immediately it was up there. And then one, you know, I don't remember exactly what it was, but some great objection. But then I had the whole thing about probability, and so on. As I showed that where you make some calculations on the chance just for a. The probability of one protein arising by chance. Cells contain, the simplest cell have at least 200 proteins that need to be there in order for the cell to function. One protein, just having one protein arising by chance. And it's a very hypothetical, it's just something in one sense, it can never happen on Earth like that, but it's kind of a hypothetical example. So then I showed some probability calculations, and whether it changed the biologist, I'm not sure, but afterward I was told there was one mathematician, professor mathematician, and he told one devotee, he was impressed, it was very good. But those who are seeped into a certain way of looking, you don't change them by even if Krishna came and played flute in front of them, they wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't say that. Out of pride, and out of if you're stuck in a certain way of looking, you cannot change your outlook. It has to do something with it. They talk about paradigms, and paradigm is a certain way of looking at the world. Because actually, we don't look at the world directly. We look at the world through ideas of what we have, what the world is, and what we confirm that's what we see, and what goes against that, we kind of don't see it, cannot see it. I don't know if anyone have made that experiment, and you know that there's a drawing of a woman's face, but it's drawn in a way. If you look at it from one side, it's an old woman. And if you look at it from the other side, it's a young woman. You've seen that drawing, yeah. So you can make that experiment in a group, but nobody has seen that, where you have the audience, you show just the young side. They only see the young girl, and then the other one sees the old girl. And then afterwards show the combined picture. And then you have them arguing. And they can even get to the point of becoming angry with each other. Because they're simply seeing something different, and to see someone else's point, someone who has a different paradigm, it's practically impossible. It's so difficult to change your paradigm.
So Chaitanya says, first we have to be humble.
Yeah.
We have to understand that we might not know.
Yeah.
But could it be so that, because I believe there's a God.
Yeah.
And I don't know how things have happened, or I can have theory like everybody else.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, so one theory in that could be that yes, God created the cell,
mm-hmm.
And God is all the time creating anew and new and new.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a. How I feel is there's an ever-present God,
mm-hmm.
all the time,
yeah.
also here.
Yeah.
And that through that, I'm not saying that I believe or don't believe or anything. I'm just saying that God can be present even if there's an evolution.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of a standard idea. Many religious people have this idea that yes, evolution. You cannot.
Because I believe that God created.
Yeah.
So.
But then also you're confronted with this massive wall where they say actually, but evolution is a fact, and how you know you cannot deny this. Like denying the Earth or claiming the Earth is flat, and you know, or denying gravity or like that. Same, you cannot deny evolution. It's just a fact. So then.
I'm saying,
but that's often many religious people. Then they kind of, you know, okay, so evolution is a fact, but that's God's way of kind of creating. He creates through evolution processes. And I say, he could. Why not? He could do that. It's, but that's not Darwin. The point is, that's not what Darwin is arguing. Darwin.
So his point is that the first cell ever coming was just made up.
Yeah, Darwin is a materialist. Darwin's idea is that life can be explained by matter. Matter.
So it's actually the first cell that is the kind of springing point here.
That's
the first cell ever.
It turns out that Darwin didn't know much about cells, because in his time, you know, the microscopes they had could see cells. You could, but the nucleus of the cell, you could see just like a black spot. And that was kind of the, you know, how powerful the microscopes were. Then Darwin thought that a cell was something very simple, like a microscope, you know, drop of mucus or something like that, something very simple. So he therefore in one sense that could also arise naturally. But Darwin does not discuss in that sense cells. Is not he discusses when life is there and evolves. But then there's, you know, science advanced.
He said he starts discussing from when life is already there.
Yeah.
Okay, so he hasn't actually got a thought about when how.
But the origin of life, in especially not in the origin of species, that he doesn't discuss it. But it's of course a question that does come up, and there are letters where he kind of just plays with the idea that, you know, it could arise on its own if you had like a place with some warm ponds, where there might be some proteins naturally, and you know, like near some volcanic area like that, and then, you know, gravity could arise on its own there. Just speculates like that. But he also says he has no basis for because actually nobody knows what life really is.
Yeah.
So
he's actually just discussing the materialistic. He's not actually discussing life.
Turns out, of course, we know life is consciousness.
Yeah.
If we
exactly.
agree with, yeah, yeah.
So
but
he's not actually discussing that.
No.
He's actually looking at life as a material.
Yeah.
Materialistic.
Yeah, and he's claiming that life can be explained materially. So, and this is what we're looking at here. Can you explain life completely materially? And
they speculated to the point when they start to believe that the consciousness is a product of the mind.
Yeah, that's standard. I mean, you go to many scientists, they convinced that the brain causes consciousness. I mean, that's
because today a lot of scientists are wondering,
yeah,
what consciousness, you know,
yeah,
this big,
yeah,
question, and also believing, you know, this consciousness,
yeah,
is ever present everywhere.
Yeah.
And
but not
because if you look, but then we're not going into the discussion that you want to, didn't want to go into.
No, that's I mean that can come little later. Yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're discussing the kind of the position of what you say mainstream science, whatever that means. But that's the science you're presented in the media, in the school books, textbooks like that,
mm-hmm,
in the National Geographic, in the whatever TV programs are there, and like the Cosmos series, isn't that a very popular thing? Cosmos by what was his name?
Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan was there. There was a. But they.
You were thinking of the Netflix thing.
Huh?
The Netflix show.
It could be his Tyson something. What was his name?
He's black.
He's black, yeah.
Yeah.
Tyson. What more than Tyson?
This Oriental person, Xiong Yun, is also popular.
That might be. I'm thinking of this Tyson.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know him. I know what.
But it's also materialist.
Yeah, he's very materialist.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what we are looking at now, and we are just. I mean, first on surface, we're just looking at some obvious flaws or weaknesses in their theory, without really getting into it, because it's such a massive topic. You know, we cannot, especially if I give this presentation to an outside audience, such as some students or some even biologists like that. I mean, there's no question of getting into starting about talking about consciousness, and you have to just take from where they are at, and then look at actually, you know, but there's so many flaws in this whole theory here. So even just to bring them to the point of doubting a little what they are believing, that's but of course we have to look at it. We have to look at consciousness, we have to also look at super consciousness, God's presence everywhere, and there's scientific evidence for that. And I mean, even origin of the universe, we have to look at that also, stuff like that. Something more? Oh, it's okay. I mean, it's just, I mean, I have much more, but this, I think it's not. Isn't
it? I feel like hunger, not for speaking anymore about Darwin, but because it, from my perspective, it's boring.
Yeah, in one sense.
Some glorification of the source of consciousness.
Yeah,
that would be nice.
but as I said, I started with a quote that the devotee is eager to also convince people that there is a God. So. So actually, no, I find in the right context, this kind of, you know, I feel very ecstatic, actually. Just being able to, you know, even create a doubt in someone who's very materialistic and like that. I mean, I cannot speak about Krishna and you know, that's...
So that was why you didn't want to talk about consciousness? As a
yeah, but it's
a here you just want to keep it on that.
Yeah, because this is a topic for this particular thing here.
Yeah.
And the next two, I know what is it, I mean, you know, I have next two is also quite physical. Forbidden Ecology is very physical, and Back to the Stone Age. I mean, that's one. Tomorrow I'll look at Forbidden Ecology. Professor Karma's work on forbidden archaeology, and then I'll have something about going back to the Stone Age, which is also, I think, in one sense relevant. We look at history, and and what do we hear? Like, for example, what was the world like 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago? You
we
read
in Africa, they say.
Huh?
We were coming from Africa.
Oh, that's before that. That's earlier. What was it like if you open a general history book 10,000 years ago? What was there?
The Ice Age just ended, something like that.
Yeah, so that's here. So here we had Ice Age ending, and people are here. And what are the what kind of people? What do we have? Civilization?
Hunter gatherers.
Hunters, gatherers, primitive Stone Age people, and so that's the idea, you know. 10,000 years ago, it was.
Maybe it's true that was the case here in Scandinavia.
That might be true here. I think it's true here. Yeah, but anyway, but that's the idea, you know. That standard history said there was primitive Stone Age people 10,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, like that. So what do the Puranas say? The Vedas say instead. Someone, you know.
Yes.
This is what I like about the theory.
Yeah, but so what is the answer? What was according to the Vedas 10,000 years ago?
People just live more simply. They were highly developed spiritually. And now it's actually not evolution, it's devolution. It's like we degrade.
Even more backwards. But also, no, actually, some people live more simple. But there was also more advanced civilization.
Oh, definitely.
Like you hear descriptions of Dwarka, you know, on the Bhagavatam. That's not people living simple. This is advanced urban civilization. In you know the palaces and you know all the you know the architecture and so on. Or you hear about the palace or the assembly house of the Pandavas. It's you know it's an incredible architectural thing, and also has a lot of technical.
Example is the pyramids.
Yeah.
They say like if they.
So we'll look at that tomorrow. So I'm just saying you have these you have these two ideas. You have the idea that it was you know 5,000 years, 10,000 years, 15,000 years, just primitive stone age people. They had some stones. They had some you know. Hammers and like that, and they were.
They didn't even have hammers because they did not have to. They know.
Yeah.
They knew
but let's just you know keep it. I'm just saying that's a topic for tomorrow.
They
so that
draw
and
draw
yeah 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 yeah, and then I don't know if there's time for that, but then the fourth thing that's about. We talk about consciousness and super consciousness and ultimately, you know, Krishna and like that.
The fourth thing, would that be on Sunday then?
I don't know. I mean, I think Sunday is just, you know, Sunday feast, isn't it? Or
you could give it then. I mean, after the Sunday feast.
Okay, it could be also the Sunday feast lecture somewhat.
Yeah, it could be.
About.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
That's like the conclusion. So you evolve up to that.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. I think we stop here, isn't it? Or yeah. It's so. Thank you for all your patience, tolerance.
Jai.
See the problem, Hare Krishna.
Jai.
Hare Krishna. Jai.
Jai.